Blog Talk Radio.
Good. Good morning, everyone. This is Literary Viewpoints, MJ Network, MJ in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, who started this whole thing and got me to do radio shows. We have a very, very interesting show, and the topic is really quite good. The Shepherd's Calculus deals with when journalist Peter Merrick is asked to write a eulogy for his mentor, Jesuit priest James Ingram, his biggest concern is doing right by the man, but you never know. But when his routine research reveals disturbing ties to cases of abuse and clues to a shadowy deal that trades justice for power, everything believed about in his friend is in question. And I'm not going to tell you any more, but I'm going to read what's at the top of the book. In the minds of the powerful, faith and justice are part of the calculation, which helps to explain the title. And C.S. Farrelly is here, and we're going to talk about it. Hi, good morning. I'm so glad you're here.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm excited because this is really a topic that could be ripped right out of the news, seriously. I mean, there's so much about that in the newspaper about pedophiles and people that, you know, in the church and stuff, not just there. And unfortunately, I taught in New York public schools, which I loved, and one of the teachers in my school turned out to be one. And that was like a whole other thing. It was horrible. So you have to really be careful. So what made you focus on the Catholic Church and corruption in it? How did you decide on this topic?
Sure. So I think, you know, to your point about ripped from the headlines, that was certainly part of it.
Yeah.
I myself was raised Catholic, and I was living in Ireland for graduate school, and at the time that the abuse cases were starting to heat up in the United States and also in Ireland, I felt very strange being abroad, because when you're traveling, sometimes your faith is something that is comforting when you're living away from home. And so at the exact moment that I was connecting with my faith in Ireland, there was a lot of negative press coming out about this, and so it became a sort of personal interest of mine. And as a result of that, I began sort of researching it and thinking about things and wondering, what is the experience of people who, like me, are having these questions because of their faith and what's happening? And I decided to put it into a fictionalized version, in part because it's a little easier to do that way. You know, if it's I myself am not a victim, so I couldn't write memoir about it, but doing a fictionalized version was an opportunity for me to explore some of the questions that I had in a creative way.
It was, let me tell you, it catches you. As a matter of fact, the book is in my hand, and there are about a lot of people that want to read it. And someone's
great, I'm excited to hear that.
Yeah, whatever I read, I go to the diner, I'll go to the bakery, wherever, and they'll go, friend, what did you read that you love? And I go, you can't have it till I'm done interviewing the author. Sorry, you're going to have to wait. So they're like, you know, I have to put a name in a hat today. Someone's going to get it. So
great.
We have the main character. Tell us about Archbishop, he's an interesting character, Owen Feeney, and how and why he thinks that he makes the rules and doesn't have to follow them. That's really pretty good, and I wonder how true that is.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, first, one of the things I tried to do with Feeney is that I really wanted to make sure that I touched on some of the anger and the issues that people have felt about the church, but in a productive way. And I think part of the question that many people have had is, how could this have happened? Because, you know, you sort of look at the experiences that you have, whether you went to a Catholic school and had phenomenal teachers, or I myself went to Fordham University down the road there in the Bronx, and I had an amazing experience. But you have to question, how does this happen when the opinion that you have is very different from the experience that you had, which is very different from the evidence and reporting that's coming out. And so I wanted to look at the structure of the church. And I think this is not a criticism specifically of the Catholic Church. It's about most large organizations that have power and influence, is that any time you reach a certain size and influence level, you put structures in place and you have to delegate power and authority to people. And, you know, it's that adage that absolute power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think there's the opportunity anytime anyone, whether it's a politician, a CEO, or someone in a high position in a religion, there's the propensity for people to become a little too comfortable with that power and make decisions that maybe benefit themselves more than than they do the organization. And that was really where I was coming from with Owen Feeney, is that I think what you see in the book is that he genuinely believes in his mission. His mission is to protect the church. And he believes that he's been embodied, you know, sort of given the authority to do that. And so all of his decisions are made to protect the church, but also to protect his position as well.
Yeah, I could tell. Well, I went to Manhattan College.
Oh, great. I used to live right down the street from Manhattan College for many, many years. I love it there.
I had a choice between Fordham for my third master's or Manhattan, and I chose Manhattan. And I wasn't sorry. I really learned. I did very well there. But it was really weird because I was the only Jewish girl in a class filled of nuns and priests. And,
oh, wow.
it was funny because the class was called Fundraising for the Catholic School. It was supposed to be something else. And the sister said to me, I think you're in the wrong place. I said, how about if I tell you fundraising for a public school or a Jewish school? And they kept me. And at the end of the class, we had to sell our school. I got the most money. So
wow,
obviously,
amazing.
it was fun. Yeah, I enjoyed myself, and everybody got. It was a fantastic family of people. So how can someone with so much power in the church and influence on practices and nobody noticed it? Is it because of him, or they didn't want to notice it, or they didn't want to believe it, or does people just tend to believe that he was doing the right thing and nobody wanted to say anything?
Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that, and I think it's definitely a theme in my writing, you know, not just with this, but in my follow-up project, the novel that I'm working on right now. A lot of what I look at is the notion of there's the individual moment of a crime or a wrong done, right? And there's, you know, they're normally limited actors in the actual moment. There's the person doing the act and the person impacted by the act. But if you dig deeper and you scratch the surface, very often there are sort of social and situational things that contribute to that moment happening. Not always, but I'm very interested in looking at, if you argue back from the moment, what happened leading up to that moment? And at any point, could someone have had done something differently that would have changed the outcome? And so I think part of what we saw in this scandal, and you see it right now, you see it with the Harvey Weinstein case, you see it with political scandals, is that it's not so much the people didn't know or didn't believe, but I think there's an element of power that says, you know, there are two things. One, I don't feel comfortable raising the alarm because I'm not powerful enough and these people are more powerful. But then there's also the, you know, even if there's not enough evidence for me to raise the alarm, you know, I'm just not going to question authority. And there is something, you know, there's a line in the book where he sort of, where Peter says to Kevin Garrity, he says, what's the one thing that you learned most about being Catholic, more than catechism or anything else? And Kevin says, you do what you're told. And Peter says, by whom? And he says, whoever is more important than you. And so I do think there's something about the structure of authority, whether it's in the Catholic Church or another religion or a political system or a corporate culture, that says, you know, whoever holds the power, you don't question them. And so that means that some of the questions that you should raise that would have sounded the alarm sooner don't get raised, and they don't get answered. So there are a couple of things where I think people who have direct knowledge don't always feel that they can challenge something. And then there are other situations where people can claim that they really had no idea because they didn't question authority.
I agree with you because of that teacher in my school. I knew something was wrong, and I reported it. And my principal waited until it was too late. And they reported it, and unfortunately, several students suffered as a result of what this man did because the man had AIDS. So you can imagine the fallout, and it was horrible. It was all over the news and everything, and he got 10 years in Rikers. And when he came out, where did they put him? By another school. Instead of housing him somewhere else, they put him right by another school. And the sad part is that he's one of the best teachers in the school. But I knew something was wrong, and I said something. But you're right. Sometimes they don't want to know. And she didn't want to know because she wanted to deal with the district and the police and everything. And when it finally came out, they said that I and one other person were the only ones in the school that really cared. And it was sad because so many kids came forward, and they were afraid. So Who is Milton
and,
Casey?
You know, I think there's another element there, too, as well, which is that, you know, when you're faced with a situation like that, how much is enough?
Yeah.
How much action is enough, right? And that's another, that's kind of part of what's behind the title. Yes, the title is when do you choose, you know, the calculation that you make about what to do and when. But even if you decide to act, right, depending on what position you're in, you might, you know, you might say, well, reporting it to my principal is enough, but I don't have authority to take it further, right? So I think there's also the calculation of when to take action and when not to, but there's also the calculation of when is the action that I've taken enough and when do I need to go further? You know, there are a lot of questions around this, you know?
Well, there's a way to always, you know, call the superintendent and not tell who you are or make them aware, and we did. But unfortunately, she was in his hip pocket until it was too late, until a parent came and brought it out in the open. And it was lucky that he did, that they did. So we have Milton Casey. Who is he and what did he do? And then we're going to get into this war between President Arthur Weincock and his competition, Thomas Archer, which brings us into the religious phase of the book, which I found interesting.
Sure. So Milton Casey is the campaign manager for the incumbent president. So as the book opens, it's in the midst of a presidential election, and the incumbent president is really kind of struggling to hold on to his lead. He doesn't have much of a challenger in the form of his established party's opponent, but there's this new sort of independent candidate named Thomas Archer who's rising up the ranks and seems to be closing in on the comfortable lead that Wincott had at the start of the book. And so Milton Casey is Wincott's campaign manager, and his role is to really kind of help his guy win, you know, and he's going to do it any way he can.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also, you know, he's not, I try to draw a real distinction that, you know, he's not a super bad guy, you know, and I think that's kind of what I try to do in the book is that none of these guys are textbook, you know, picked up a gun and fired it at someone. But they all did stuff that you're like, well, did you ever stop to think that maybe that wasn't the most moral or ethical thing to do? And the answer is they didn't, because they wanted to win. Right. And I think that's something that we're seeing a lot of in American culture right now. You see it in politics. You see it in capitalism. You know, it's all over the place. So that real sort of putting the individual desire to win over the collective good is a cultural moment that we're having that I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with. Certainly I am.
Yeah. Well, there are some people that think they're in power like God and forget that there are other people that are got them there, and that it's a two-party system, and that it's a government, it's a democracy, and you're not the only one. And that's what's really scary, is that, you know, some people think they have so much power. Well, really, actually, they don't. So tell us about this presidential election, and every presidential election is so cutthroat. I would hope to see someday, and it's probably never going to happen, a presidential election based on the issues, not based on corruption and mudslinging. That would be a first.
It would be a first. So, you know, I think what's really funny about the most recent presidential election in the United States is that I wrote the first draft of the book. I finished the first draft of the book many years ago, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it, if anything at all. And you sort of finish writing a book, and you feel so accomplished, but then you know you have to edit it, so you put it on a shelf because you're just a little tired of it by that point. And so I put it away, and at the time, you know, I remember thinking as I was rereading it, and certainly some of the feedback that I got from editors and agents as I was trying to shop it around was, well, you know, it's a bit far-fetched. I'm not sure the plot is truly believable. And so what's been really interesting about the last year and a half is that, you know, whether you believe the allegations of intervention into the election by Russia or not, you know, the novel alleges an intervention from a foreign power, right? And, you know, there are a lot of things about the current election that sort of make me feel like the plot wasn't as far-fetched, even though I could not possibly have predicted that. But I think, you know, we are in a kind of watershed moment here where people are trying to talk about the issues again. And, you know, in some ways, I think you have to reach an extremity point where people get so disillusioned that they start speaking up and saying, I want to talk about issues like healthcare. I want to talk about issues like poverty. I want to talk about issues of fair taxation, the crumbling infrastructure of the United States. You know, we've had, in 1 week alone, we had 3 different train crashes. You know, there are things that we need to address, and the drama being played out, you know, in the public sphere with journalism and coverage, you know, that's not getting the job done. At some point, we need to settle down and say who's going to start getting stuff done. And I don't know that that always should be on the federal level, or could it be on the federal level, regardless of what administration was in power. But I think you have people going to their state level and local level and local elections and getting involved and saying, we want to make some changes, we want to be involved. So that's not a bad thing.
No, it's not a bad thing. It really is a great thing. I'll tell you, I read something on Google this morning that really was disturbing. As an educator, I always celebrated Black History Month, and I felt that children should know about their culture. I did Puerto Rican history, Jewish history, everything in a school that was African American. And we talked about, and then this morning some principal said in PS 224 in the Bronx that they could not deal with Black history, and she's being investigated. And I think it's good, because what's wrong with talking about Dr. King or anybody else? I used to pick the Black Americans that nobody heard of, people that did things that no one ever knew. And I thought that was important too. So you have that in here too. My next question is, we have Archer's speech. He's speaking to this in Spanish. Why did he decide to target Latinos and middle class workers? And does every politician have a specific target group that they're looking for, that they feel they can get the most votes?
Mm-hmm. So part of that was, again, when I was researching the book, there were a number of, nothing in the book is based on fact itself. So I need to make sure that I say that, so mm-hmm. no one feels that I'm sort of accusing any campaign of anything.
Yeah.
But, back in 2004, I remember during the John Kerry, George Bush election, there was a lot of back and mm-hmm. forth about targeting religious voters, specifically evangelicals. And New York Times and a couple of other newspapers covered their targeting of Catholic voters. And so identity politics has always been, a fairly large portion of campaigning in the United States. You certainly saw it during the JFK campaign in the 60s, and it's continued on. And so part of my personal interest in it was the backstory that I created for Thomas Archer, which is that he converts to Catholicism as a result of living in Central America doing work with the Peace Corps. So for him, he wasn't born Catholic. He has an epiphany later in his life where he decides that this is the faith that he wants to pursue. And he does that because when he was on the ground working in a war-torn area of Central America, he got to know people working alongside him who happened to be Jesuits and nuns, doing really wonderful relief work. And so that's kind of part of his narrative of the epiphany that he had about his faith. But I also did it because, I lived for many years in the Bronx, and the Bronx mm-hmm. has a large Latino population. And so I think it was one thing to be living there with neighbors and in a neighborhood where I saw a lot of wonderful things, very community-oriented, people who were very friendly, all that sort of thing, and then watching that play out on the national stage with the debates about immigration. And I'm not going to say that my experience encapsulates everyone's experience mm-hmm. or that there aren't genuine, legitimate questions about legal immigration that need to be answered. But I think part of what mm-hmm. I was trying to get at with Archer is that Archer sort of says, look, I'm here to represent the United States in all of its glory. And a good portion of the United States' glory is our immigrant history. We are as rich and, a contextually and culturally rich nation because we have immigration from all over the world and always have. And so that's part of what makes him feel proud and want to be president is his appreciation for that. And so I really wanted to capture that. And, because I see so much of the immigration debate seems to be targeted on mm-hmm. on immigration from Central and South America, I wanted to address that in a quiet way.
No, I thought that was great. I grew up in the South Bronx. And then I moved to Pelham Parkway, so I'm a Bronx person. And
oh, yeah.
You're right.
I love the Bronx.
In the Bronx.
Did you see all my shout-outs to the Bronx in the book?
Yep, I know. And I knew all those places that you shouted out to. Ha!
Yep.
And I go to the Bronx every Saturday to get my hair done. I'm faithful to my hairdresser. Yep. I go to Allerton Avenue. I go to Luigi's, and I've been going there for forever. And I wouldn't go anyplace else. And I even go to the diner, and my butcher's in the Bronx. So I'm a Bronx person, and growing up in the South Bronx, you get tough. And in the Bronx, it was the best profession ever. If my mom wasn't diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I probably never would have retired ever. And I think the best testament to how I did was my students are on Facebook, and they keep reminding me of all the wonderful things I did for them. I said, thank God you're not telling me I was horrible. No.
That's
so
wonderful.
We've got James Ingram, and he was in an accident. But what letters does James Ingram have in his hand, and what red flags go up? And then we have what priest, this is serious, because it's been in the news a lot. What are some priests accused of abuse, and what kind? And this really does happen. That's the sad focus of it, but it's a fact. So why did you choose that, and what does James Ingram have that comes out?
Sure. So I, again, in thinking about, my experiences and the research that I was doing, I think, you know, we talked earlier about why don't people speak up, and it's that power, right? But, I think there's also the element of who are you supposed to trust, and who are your moral guideposts when you're growing up? And it's very much your teachers, right? Because these are, the adults that you spend the most time with, aside from your parents and your immediate and extended family, are your instructors. And if your family is religious, then, the people who are involved with your faith. And so for me, making it a priest was a natural leap for me. And also because I wanted to explore the idea of duality, right? There's a point in the book where Peter says, how could someone who is responsible for really wonderful things like helping families and building community centers also be doing this? Right? How could someone who is really wonderful also be a pedophile? And that to me is the nature of all of these moral questions that we have about humanity, right? We, on a daily basis, we see examples of the best in humanity and the worst in humanity. Human beings are not always wonderful. We are complex, flawed. We make decisions that are very harmful to other people, but we also make decisions that are extremely beneficial for others. So I really wanted to capture that idea that, evil and good can coexist in one person, and we see it every day. And on a macro level, with global war, or on a micro level. Mm-hmm. And so what we kind of see in the novel is what I wanted to have set Peter off on this journey of trying to find out the truth is that he discovers a series of letters that were returned to Ingram unopened, and curiosity gets the better of him, and he opens them and he reads them. And, Ingram is apologizing to people, saying, I'm really sorry for the damage that was done to you. And so his mind has to go, where it goes, which is, geez, in this day and age when you've had so many cases that have come out about abuse, is it possible that someone who I love, admire, and respected could have been a pedophile? And so that's really what kicks off the first mystery in the book that unravels this other series of events that uncovers the scandal, is that he needs to know for his own peace of mind if the person that he thought James Ingram was is really who he was.
So it took 10 years to bring this to light. And then there's monetary recompense because the church is being sued. A church is looking, as Feeney relates, there's one Monsignor that is up on charges, and they keep moving him around. And they're paying out $700 million in counterclaims. How would he and the church get around this? I mean, he's going to say it didn't happen or it did happen, and how do you get around something like that when it's brought out and out into the open?
Yeah, I mean, that's stuff like that, yeah, it's, that's another area that I looked to real life in my research to try to figure out what the plot would do. And I think what you sort of found in the research was that you had some people who legitimately thought, I'm going to do what I can to help this individual who needs help. And there were some dioceses that sent their priests who were pedophiles. They sent them for psychological treatment, and they did successfully remove them from working with children. There are others that thought, well, no, we can just move them around. I think what came up in my research that was one of the inspirations for the plot point about money was that the current Archbishop of New York, Timothy Dolan, when he was in his previous position, the New York Times has covered this, the Baltimore Sun has covered this, he moved property and assets that were owned by the church at the time into offshore accounts so that they couldn't be counted for compensation for damages. And, that's not the first time that's happened. If you do some research on it, it's, it's what every corporation does when it's trying to protect its assets, right? You see it in personal divorce, right? When people are getting a divorce, they might move their assets. Mm-hmm. O.J. Simpson moved a bunch of his assets offshore so that when he was sued in civil court, he couldn't be forced to fork over the money.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's something that you see large corporations do when they move into protective mode. And so it really struck me as... maybe it was the legally smart thing to do, but it wasn't the morally correct thing to do. You know, if the church owed those victims money, they should have paid up. They shouldn't have been looking at creative ways to exploit loopholes to move assets around so they didn't have to be held responsible. And so that, you know, reading that research and reading some of those news articles very much informed that plot point.
I agree with you. A lot of people think they can do things and they make decisions and never think that there are going to be any consequences at the end of the rainbow. They have no idea. They don't care. So,
yeah. Or if they don't see the consequences, that they don't exist.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, in their minds, yeah, I can get away with this because I'm in power and because I said so and I know the right people. I mean, I just read a book by Larry Thompson that, oh, my God, White Witch. It's about Annie Palmer that was considered a white witch and her voodoo and how she killed her husbands and slaves, whatever. And the book was like, because I can do it. Because we can do this, I can get away with it, and it doesn't really matter. Like, people are above the law, and the person that was coming in to do this buckshot mind thought that she could pay off all the higher-ups and wasn't going to get caught. So tell us more about Casey and Cardinal Mulcahy and their secret meeting on the upcoming election, because these two are not so wonderful either.
Yeah. So, you know, that relationship is, essentially Casey is someone who is hired, he's good at campaigns. He's good at figuring out what it's going to take to win. And so that's why people hire him. That's why Wincott hired him. And one of the things that he recognizes early on is that if you're going to try to reach out to, a particular group that you're trying to influence, you have to understand what's going to influence them, why, and how. And so, I think with Allie's research, she sort of says, hey, this is the voting population that you need to target. And she kind of leaves it up to Casey about how to target them. But, and again, certainly with the immigrant population in the United States, they're not all Catholic. There are plenty who are not. But there are a large number who are Catholic. And so he happens to know Mulcahy through, other means. And he calls him up and sort of says, hey, we have this problem. How do we connect with this population and make them listen to us about why Wincott should be their choice? And, Mulcahy puts them in touch with Feeney, because Feeney is someone who understands the power that the sheer numbers of voting Catholics have, right? And so they make a deal. And I think that's not any different than an advertising company does. A large corporation does it. You figure out who are going to be your buyers, and you figure out how to get the message out to them in the most effective way. And that's essentially what they've done here.
Well, I'm glad you put Allie in and Casey in. So why wouldn't the Archbishop meet with Casey? And how many sexual abuses were there? And they tried to push them all under the carpet. It's as if, yeah, it happened, but don't worry about it because it really didn't happen. And nobody really – I guess the Archbishop, that person has a lot of power. And I guess
– He does, yeah.
It didn't get to the Pope, did it? No.
Well – And in, it doesn't go as high as that, but there's the Congregation for the Prefect of the Faith. There are various levels within the Vatican that are fairly senior, and so it doesn't actually get all the way to the Pope, but they run it up the flagpole to where they need to. In the case of Mulcahy choosing not to meet with Casey, the reason he does it is because he himself is embroiled in a bit of a sort of scandal where he is, because there a lot of news is broken about cover-ups. So in his mind, he sort of thinks, he's already being he's in the crosshairs of the media for being involved with a lot of this abuse stuff, so it doesn't make any sense for him to meet in publicly with a representative from a political campaign. It would just be damaging for Wincott. So that's why he sets up the meeting with Feeney and turns it over from there.
Well, I think I have a lot of so many questions that I'm not sure we're going to get to all of them, but I'm going to try to get to most of them.
No worries.
We have Eric Beto. What is Good Shepherd? And the name alongside an article on an abuse survivor website. And what is Beto reveal? What does he let everybody
sure, so
know?
Sure. That whole section is really kind of mm-hmm. trying to take the writer through Peter's thought process and how Peter pieces mm-hmm. everything together. And, you know, I did that partially because the way that I do research, I sort of emulated the way I do research. You know, I'm not a journalist, but I've done enough freelancing of articles and I've written scholarly articles and this, that, and the other. And so a lot of what I'll do is sometimes if I'm trying to track something down, I'll just start with a Google search and I'll start throwing out some paired search terms and see what comes up. And so, you know, when Peter tries to find out information about each of the recipients of the letters that have been returned, he starts by doing a couple of Google searches and narrowing it down from there. And, you know, the first couple of articles he finds on Eric Botter are about, you know, Eric having been a powerhouse baseball player growing mm-hmm. up. But then, you know, he starts going down the list of all the returns, and he happens to find Eric's name listed on a survivor website. And so even though it doesn't say anything about, you know, it doesn't reveal specific details about Eric's particular case, the fact that Eric is matched with that website indicates to Peter, okay, you know, first Peter Googled one person, and he found out that person committed suicide. He Googled someone else who was involved, you know, in a lawsuit about it, and now he's Googled Eric Botter, and he sort of finds that he's affiliated with the Survivor Network. And so that's when Peter starts to believe, wow, you know, maybe James Ingram was a pedophile, and I'm only just discovering this now.
Mm. Well, there's one character that I'm going to leave out, and that's the person that gets moved around, so we don't want to tell everybody about him.
Okay.
So I just crushed that out. It's like wondering, I look at the top of the page and I'm saying, okay, wait a minute, I've got to get rid of that. You told Kevin Garrity's story, and I got a box of tissues out. What happened at the interview with Peter that will tear your heart apart? This poor guy, I felt so bad for him that if the person that did this to him was standing there, I probably would have gotten him myself. So tell us a little bit about Kevin Garrity. And then how do you let readers hear Ingram's voice? That was really good.
Yeah, so with Garrity, I think, you know, again, that was a scene that I spent a lot of time researching because I think, you know, again, I myself am not a survivor of any sexual abuse, but I think if you're going to tell the story of someone who is, you have to be very sensitive mm-hmm. to that. And so I did an awful lot of research. I spoke with different therapists to say, you know, none of the therapists I spoke to divulged any sensitive information, but, you know, I'd say to them, what are some of the themes and what do people feel? Help me understand what the experience is for them and things like that. And I think, you know, what I really tried to get to with Kevin is that there's a bond and a trust that you have in adults when you're a small child that is broken when this happens to you. And, you mm-hmm. know, it's not that anyone who's ever abused can't ever recover from it. There are plenty of examples of people doing it. But I think you have to honor what happened to someone in a situation like that. You have to be willing to say, no, there was a trust broken, and it's very difficult to return that trust. And so part of creating that, you know, that relationship that Kevin had with Ingram was, you know, Ingram was trying to rebuild trust and trying to make things better. And so I think in order to really kind of capture why that was so important for Kevin, you know, why to anyone else it was just a small gesture sending a letter, what could a letter possibly do? You know, shouldn't Kevin get money? Shouldn't Kevin get something else? You know, it really makes you realize that anyone saying, I'm sorry this happened to you and it was wrong and let me do what I can, is meaningful.
I just crossed out another question based on that other person again. I'm getting good at this. Okay, so we're going to bring Allie Larkin in. You know, at times I wanted to say to her, Allie, focus, open up your eyes, but she's very naive. And she appears to be naive, and the choice is perfect and changes it. Tell us about Mark and the research he wants her to do and why, and what is faith-based initiatives, because she gets caught in the crossfire because she's going to have to make a decision as between her moral values and what's right, what's, you know, what she knows. You know, sometimes people need money so badly that they'll do anything. So tell us more about her and what kind of research does her boss want her to do and what does she find out?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Allie is an interesting character for me because I, you know, people will often ask you, are there any books, you know, are there any characters in a book who's based on yourself? And I've had a couple of people say, is Allie based on you? And it's funny because I could not be more different from Allie. I'm probably more like Peter. I'm a little cynical. I have a tendency to kind of doubt things and really kind of want to dig into them and get to the bottom of it. But it was really important for me that Allie have a journey because, you know, at the start of the book, she's just recently graduated from college. She's moved to Washington, D.C. It's this really exciting time in her life, but she's not sure what she wants. And, you know, I think that's the experience for a lot of kids. They graduate from college. All of a sudden, the world is open to them. And there's some who are very focused. They know that they want to go, they want to join military service. They want to become physicians. They want to become scientists or lawyers. But there are a lot of people who don't really know. All they know is kind of, you know, I need a job. I need to kind of figure myself out. And for Allie, you know, regardless of how confused she's ever been in her life before, her religious faith is something that grounds her and anchors her. And so that's why it was really important for me, for her to kind of stay somewhat naive, because I think she's meant to kind of represent, how could you have so many people who never ask the question? And that's, and the answer to that is that if your faith has always given you what you need, you believe in it. So you don't necessarily ask questions. You know, you believe what someone tells you until you catch them the first lie. And then you start asking questions. And so Allie's never really had this experience before, whereas Peter's always been a little more doubtful of things. And so, you know, I really wanted Allie to kind of represent that. You know, people who didn't ask questions aren't necessarily bad. They just needed to have a couple of experiences to wake them up a little bit. And that was important to me. And in terms of the faith-based initiative office, that was really, you know, it's based on a real office. There, you know, there is a faith-based initiative presence in the White House, and it's meant to kind of recognize, it's an office that does very good work. So, you know, its inclusion in the book is in no way kind of an indictment of that office, but it's an office that recognizes that the United States, you know, for all of its sort of secular language in its constitution, we are a nation that has, in part because of our immigration past, a lot of religious entities here. And so how do we kind of merge the community building that we want to do with the fact that we have, whether it's synagogues, you know, or Catholic churches out in the community doing great work. So that's the office that she's doing some research on. And you know, that's because they look at her background. Mark, her manager, looks at her background and says, you're someone who kind of loves this stuff. You're involved in the community because of your faith. How about you get involved with this?
Well, I'm going to ask like four questions and one's on my next page. But before I forget, you should be interested. Tomorrow should be very interesting. I'm doing a show on Valentine's Day, and Rachel and Michael will be here. And they developed Trinity House Entertainment, Inc. It's Christian music. It's for everybody. You don't have to be Christian or Catholic to listen to the music. The words are fantastic. And it's for Valentine's Day to inspire love, kindness, understanding, and being nice to people. And it's just supposed to teach you that there are other things through music. You can feel relaxed and you can learn love and you can learn to deal with your problems by listening to the songs. And I listen to every one of them. And they're going to be there tomorrow and they are going to share some of the music. And they're going to share how they co-created the organization and how they created the songs. On the 19th, John Vanderslice, The Last Words of Oscar Wilde. On the 21st, like a Romeo and Juliet star-crossed lovers poem, The Book of Lovers. On the 26th, I'm so psyched out, Vincent Zandri, The Detonator. On the 28th, Brian Freeman, The Voice Inside. And on the 1st, to start off March the right way, New York Times author, mystery writer, one of the best criminal defense lawyers in the world, Philip Margolin, The Third Victim. And that's just some of what's coming up. There's a whole lot more. And so let's go back to, who is Steve? And she's forced to work with him. And there's a report that comes out, and he steals her ideas. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so, well, Steve Tilden is one of Allie's coworkers, and, I mean, first, Tilden is a shout-out to the Bronx, because when I lived there and used to go over to Fordham, I would pass Tilden Avenue. But Steve is her coworker, and she has a bit of a sort of competition with him. And, you know, part of it is, again, I think part of what you're seeing in contemporary American culture, the whole kind of rhetoric of drain the swamp and this, that, and the other thing, is that there's a sense that politics, particularly in the United States, is a, you know, you only get into it if you're wealthy, and you only get into it if you know the right people. There's a nepotism at work, and if you come from the right background, you can get the right job, and you can work for the right people. And so part of Allie's background is that she doesn't fit that. She doesn't fit that narrative. She sort of lucks into the job because they need a token Catholic. She seems like she's pretty knowledgeable, and she lands there, and she's not like the other kids working in the office. And Steve is someone who basically has the job because, you know, his parents were huge donors to the campaign, and he gets the job, and he's a bit smarmy. He's kind of, you know, and we've all had a coworker like that who you're just is kind of a creep, and he sort of resents that Allie's there when she's not like him, and he doesn't understand why she should get to be there when she's not, and so they have this sort of friendly, not so friendly competition going, and so when he recognizes that she's kind of edging up because her ideas are really valuable and she's starting to assert herself, which is part of Allie's growth as a character, he, you know, needs to kind of make himself look really good, and he takes credit for an idea of hers, and it infuriates her. And part of the reason I really wanted to include that is that, you know, in addition to the sort of harassment scene that you're seeing a lot of around the Harvey Weinstein scandal, the Me Too movement, there are a lot of conversations about women in the workplace and, you know, how do we assert ourselves and what are some of the experiences that we have? Well, harassment is certainly one of them, but there are also experiences where, you know, our word is not taken seriously because of who we are. You know, a male colleague can suggest the same thing, and it's seen as being a great idea. Or, you know, in my own personal experience, I had, you know, I have a fairly assertive personality. And, you know, I had a male colleague who was even more assertive than I was. And he was described as being take charge and, you know, reliable. And people know that he can get things done. Even he's tough but fair. And then in the discussion with me, the very same manager said, yeah, but, you know, you've got quite a strong personality. And it was just, you know, that the variation says if you're assertive and you're a man, that means you're effective. If you're assertive and a female, it means you're difficult. And so I wanted to kind of capture part of what women deal with in that regard. And that experience with Steve was my way of exploring that with Allie.
I agree with you. I was told by my principal, because I stood up for myself, the last person I worked with, and I stood up for the teachers, and I was the dean. That I was confrontational. I said, no. I said, I just voiced my opinion because I'm here to help the students and the teachers, and I want them to succeed. And her answer to me was, the teachers need to fail on their own and the students too. I said, then you were in the wrong place. I said, because this is the house of education, and we don't fail on my watch. So, yeah, I understand that. So we've got we have Ernesto Horta, and they target him, and they meet with him. And with Allie. So what does Steve say to him that turns him off? And why is having him on the right side of the election important to even Weinkoch or even the other candidate? Why do they need him?
Sure. They need him because they need to understand how they're going to get, you know, Latino voters to vote for them. Now, you know, Ernesto Horta is not the only person, you know, in the world or even in the context of the book who can explain the mindset of community, you know, and I think that's one of the pitfalls of identity politics is that you think that by talking to one person you can somehow, you know, capture the attitude of an entire group of people, and you can't. And that scene is kind of meant to demonstrate that. Right? You know, Allie and Steve, like, get on their train in Washington, D.C. They do all their research. They come in there with all their papers, and they think, wow, because we've done research and we're sitting here with a Latino man, he's going to be able to unlock the secrets and tell us how to get them to vote for us. Mm-hmm. And that whole scene is kind of meant to sort of make fun of that, you know, because Horta is like, look, I can tell you what I think, and I can tell you what a couple of people around me think, but I don't speak for everyone. You know, you can't just kind of show up here every 4 years looking for some magical insight into the mind of a Latino voter and expect that it's going to solve everything. Like, we're complex people. We don't, you know, we don't always vote on our faith. We don't, you can't make snap sweeping judgments like that. And so, you know, when Steve kind of brings up, Steve speaks to him in a way that kind of betrays their only reason for being there is to get the votes, right? Like Steve says, how are we going to sort of, how are we going to appeal to your demographic, right? He doesn't refer to them as people.
Mm-hmm.
He refers to them as a demographic. And that really puts Ernesto Horta off because he's like, you know, look, you guys, you come here every 4 years. You don't care about us any other time. And then you come up and you call us a demographic. We're not a demographic. We're human beings. You know, we're families. We're community members. Yes, we're immigrants, but we're so many more things. And so the point of that scene was really to sort of say, you know, if you really want to appeal to voters, get to know them for who they are. Don't try to make assumptions about them based on, you know, what some data machine tells you. Get to know the human being behind it. That's the only way that we're really going to connect with. That's the only way we're going to connect with people and create a political system that has impact.
Maybe they need to tell that to the people that just ran for office and the ones that are going to run for office.
I would not disagree.
I tend to just say what I think. That's just me. So we've got Archer, and this is interesting. They have Weinkoch and Archer. Archer is for pro-life and pro-choice. And he wants to direct funds to help communities like the one that Horta lives in and stated that they would get first options. How would this affect the church who disbelieves in that? And which side does Weinkoch come out on when it relates to this particular issue? Because that's a controversial issue that I have my own beliefs in, and I'm not going to bring them out. But what happens when, I mean, pro-choice and pro-life, I mean, and he believes in that, and then someone else might not. How would that affect the Catholic Church?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of strains here. There's one, the sort of pro-life question, pro-life, pro-choice question. And then there's the question of, you know, Archer wants to sort of make churches pay taxes on the profits that they make, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're two separate issues, but they're kind of aligned, all right? So Archer, one, you know, part of the reason I brought that sort of controversial topic into it is because it's one that politicians lean on very heavily, right? And you see it all the time. It's sort of, and I have to say, it's kind of a lazy answer, right? If you're defining your politician only by his or her position on one thing and not saying, okay, so talk to me about what you mean by pro-choice or pro-life, because it's not any one thing. It's not black and white. There are very often people who say, I'm pro-choice, but I'm uncomfortable with late-term abortions. Or there will be people who say, I'm pro-life, but I don't just mean pro-life when it comes to abortion. I'm pro-life in that I think that you need to make sure that people who are in poverty get fed, that kids get educated and fed. You know, you can't cut programs like SNAP and CHIP because being pro-life means that you're pro-life for the entirety, not just when they're in the womb, right? So, you know, I think there's part of why I brought that up was to kind of say, here we have politicians who are trying to get easy, lazy votes. They want to have, you know, bullet point systems that say, this is who I am. I'm pro-choice, so vote for me. Or I'm pro-life, vote for me. They don't want to actually have to answer for what that means for them and what that means for how they'll govern people who may or may not agree with them, right? So, you know, and that was kind of part of that to establish that they have that background, but also to sort of say, you know, Archer as a pro-choice candidate, the Catholic Church isn't going to be terribly happy with him, frankly. So even though he's a Catholic candidate, they're not going to feel super happy about endorsing him because he doesn't agree with them on a key matter of principle for the church. And that was very much modeled after John Kerry as a candidate in 2004, is that if you look at the research, you know, there was guidance, there was a lot of coverage at the time that said, should John Kerry be allowed to take communion because, you know, he's pro-choice, but that's directly opposed to the church's teaching. So that was a portion of what that was meant to do for Archer. When it comes to Archer's plan for making churches pay taxes on profits, that's very much aligned with his notion about pro-choice, because Archer's not just pro-choice when it comes to abortion. He's pro-life when it comes to helping everyone. So his whole ideology and messaging around immigration and poverty is, you cannot be pro-life and not care about the well-being of people in the lowest of circumstances. You have to help them, right? It's all one and the same. So even though he's pro-choice, when it comes to the question of abortion, it's because his overall mindset is, I'm pro-life, I'm pro-helping people who need it to be fed and educated. So for him, when he looks at the way that churches have been behaving, what he sees is, and you saw this in New York, right? The New York City Catholic Church was one of the biggest real estate holders in the area. They owned, you know, a lot of real estate, and they sold a lot of it off, right? So his point is, look, you know, churches get a tax break because the argument is we're not really corporations, we're community institutions. We're important for building strong communities. This is why we shouldn't be taxed the way a corporation is taxed. All right, fine. You know, if that's really what you do, then great. But if you start selling off property and leaving the community who needs you, and you're selling that property off for a profit, then you should be taxed on it like it's your corporation. Because if you were behaving like a corporation and no longer behaving like a community staple or a nonprofit, then you should be taxed like a corporation. So that's the ideology behind Archer's suggestion.
Well, we have a very controversial topic here that leads both ways, and the tort reform bill. And what happens if Wyckoff's reform bill is passed? And what does Allie learn about it? And what are her options? And she has to deal with this with Peter Merrick, too. So how does that come into play? I'm not going to ask you to describe Title C, Division C, Title II, 101. I memorized this thing, which allows the tort reform complexion to change and would allow defense contractor McIntyre Industries to save $380 million in damages and legal fees. So we're not going to explain that, but explain the importance of the tort reform bill and
so
how that would change the election.
Yeah, so this is another thing that, you know, again, like when I was writing the book, I thought, oh, it's too far-fetched. But now that we're in this current political climate, it doesn't seem quite so far-fetched. So the tort reform bill essentially says that it's going to cap the damages that can be paid out. So the whole idea behind it is that the proponents of the tort reform bill are saying, look, you know, the United States has become so litigious. You know, we have someone who spills coffee on her. She orders hot coffee from McDonald's. She spills it on her lap, and then she turns around and she sues McDonald's for the coffee being hot. Right. That's ridiculous. That sort of paying out for these damages for these frivolous suits is really a hindrance to the United States, and it's wasting resources and it's costing companies money. And, you know, with trickle down economics, if these companies are having to pay for damages that they shouldn't have to pay for, then that's not going back into the economy. So we're going to put through this tort reform bill that says we're going to cap damages. Now, that's kind of, you know, a general call for it, which is pretty aligned to the GOP, how the GOP feels about regulation. They don't want regulation. They'd like to see a more favorable legislation that protects companies. So that's pretty standard for the GOP, and Wyckoff is a GOP candidate. Where it gets a little different for the novel is that a provision in it includes churches in that, churches and nonprofits. So what that essentially means, the reason that's a game changer, is that if this tort reform bill goes through, for example, the Catholic Church as an entity that has had several people, you know, hundreds of people sue them, they could benefit from this tort reform bill that says, hey, you know, we're going to cap the civil damages. So, you know, maybe 500 lawsuits are filed against the church, and the total damages for that is going to be $2 billion. Well, if this tort reform bill goes through, it'll be capped at a certain amount of money, and the church won't have to pay as much as it otherwise would have. So that's the real game changer from a plot perspective, and that really helps you understand what was in it for Owen Feeney. You know, why did Owen Feeney and why did Mulcahy want to help Wyckoff? Well, this is the quid pro quo. This is what Wyckoff promises them in exchange. And again, it's one of those things that seemed far-fetched when I was writing it. But in the past couple of months alone, you know, we've just had this, the Consumer Protection Bureau is being disbanded. Well, this is, you know, this is a government entity whose sole job is to say, hold on, when corporations misbehave and consumers are impacted, we have to hold them accountable. Well, now they're disbanding the power of that entity. So, you know, there was another piece in the tax reform bill that was just passed at the end of last year. There's a key piece of that sort of says, you know, we're going to cap damages. We're not going to cap damages, but we're going to force people into mediation for damages for banking. right? So, you know, this is, at the time I was writing it, it seemed really far-fetched, but now we have two examples that are exactly what was happening in the book, that are happening in contemporary politics right now.
I know, and I've been to arbitration and mediation. There's a total difference between both of them, too. And if you go to mediation, at least you have a leg to stand on if you don't like the decision. I went to arbitration, and you cannot appeal. Once the judge says whatever, that's just what it is. That's what happens. So you're taking a chance. You have to really know what your issue is before you decide to do either one. So before we end, we have corruption, moral values, money laundering, fraud, abuse, the integrity of the church, and more. These are some of the things that every character in the book has to deal with. What does Allie learn at the end of the book? What is her fate? And what does she learn about this?
Yeah, well, I think one of the key takeaways for Allie is that, you know, power is something that you're supposed to want, right? Like the nature of the United States and the culture that we have here is you see it everywhere. You see, you know, people who are celebrities have power and influence. People who are politicians have power and influence. CEOs, power and influence. So whether we realize it or not, we really have a subtext of sending a message to people that power is really important. And at the start of the book, you know, you can sense that Allie, it feels like she should want this. She should be really excited that she's working on a campaign. She should be really proud of it. But she doesn't really know what to do with it. Does she want to be powerful? Is this a career path that she wants? And as it turns out, she has a knack for it. She's very good at it. Her strategic thinking skills are very strong, even though she's not the sort of typical background. Milton Casey sees that she's very talented. And so, you know, that's part of her conflict in the book. When Peter comes to her and says, here's some of the stuff that I've found, and I want you to help me bring these guys down, she sort of says, look, I don't really know whether what you're telling me is true or not. And even so, you know, Milton Casey has invested in me. He's been a good mentor to me. He's helping me sort of build my career. I should be grateful for that. And so I think what we see in her journey is by the end of the book, she recognizes that, you know, sometimes power is what you want, but sometimes it comes at too high a personal cost. And for Allie, you know, for Peter, it probably wouldn't be that high a cost because he's seen a lot more of the world. But for Allie, her morality and her sense of ethics and integrity is very, very much tied to her sense of Catholicism. And it's a really disappointing experience for her to sort of see the truth about how the power has been corrupted in her own church. And I think she walks away from the experience thinking, you know, if this is how people in power are going to behave, I don't think I really want this for my life. It's not what I want to do with my career. And that's what she walks away with. And she walks away with the notion that she can and should question things and challenge people, and that it's always a good time to do the right thing. You know, you should always stand up and do the right thing when you can, because it's important.
Well, some people are afraid because they're afraid they're going to be shot down or worse. But what is next for you, and where can we learn more about your work and you bringing Allie back?
Yeah, so what is next is I'm working on a second novel. It's a little more of a traditional mystery. This one, I think, sometimes people were a little confused about this, you know, even myself when I was trying to figure out how to characterize it, because, you know, there's not a murder in it. It's not a traditional kind of thriller or mystery. But the second novel is. It opens with the discovery of a dead body, so you know that someone's been murdered from the start. And then it kind of follows the various strains. It'll be very similar to The Shepherd's Calculus in that the narrative style is going to be told from different viewpoints, right? The Shepherd's Calculus follows three different stories that kind of converge at the end, and the second novel is going to do something similar, but it is a bit more of a traditional murder mystery. And Allie and Peter are going to make an appearance in the second novel, though they're not going to be main characters. They're going to be characters that the main character knows, because the setup is the murder takes place in a very small town. And the person who kind of begins investigating it happens to be visiting from his job in Washington, D.C., where he knows Allie and Peter. So they're going away. They won't be the main characters, but they'll be there. Well, you can follow my...
Where can we find out about everything? All your books and everything.
Sure. Yep, my website, which is www.csfarrelly.com. CSFarrelly.com. That's CSFarrelly.com. So my author website has lots of information, a couple of reviews on the book. And you can also follow my Facebook page, CS Farrelly Author. And I also have a Twitter account, CS Farrelly Twitter account. My handle is at Swift Retort. So any of those areas are good places to find out what's going on with me.
Well, that's. I want to thank Cheryl. Is going to listen later. She's not feeling well. She's under the weather. So we're going to send her a shout out to Cheryl, Wendy, and Gina. Partners in Crime is the best. They did mine.
They really are. I have to say, it's been fantastic to work with. Yes.
Aren't they great? And they did mine for A Daughter's Promise, which is my memoir about my mom who had Alzheimer's. It's a true story. So from my point of view and hers, and they won Cover of the Year for 2017. And I'm hoping to get at least honorable mention next month for Book of the Year from Forward Reviews. But the fact that they even took it is good enough for me. So if they consider it
wonderful.
For anything, that would be a miracle. You just never know, right? But I want to thank you. This was so informative and so great. And I hope I get the next one. Are you planning to do another tour with them? Because if you are, I know they're going to just send me the book. They're not even going to
ask. Yes, I will be doing another tour. I'm only about, I'd say, about 85 pages into the new novel because I had to sort of take time out to do a lot for this one, but slowly making progress on
mm-hmm.
it. And I will certainly keep you posted. And, you know, again, I don't know if you're going to be in the area, but for you and any of your listeners in the New York area, I'll be doing a book signing with author Malachy McCourt at the Yonkers Public Library, the Grinton Will Branch, this Sunday at 2 o'clock. So, you know, that's a good place to get some information and copies of the book as well. But either way, I will be in touch with you about my follow-up novel.
I hope so. And you know what? It's really nice that they're doing it because the library near me doesn't do it for local authors. So that's really great that they considered, you know, doing it and taking your book in the library. I hope they put it on the shelf. That would be really nice, too.
Yeah, definitely.
So I want to thank you so much. This has been really informative. I love this book. And, of course, I read it twice because I wanted to make sure that I got it. And it usually takes me about an hour and a half to read a book, seriously. But I couldn't put this one down. And, yeah, they're about somebody's getting this right after the show. I can promise you that. And so I'm going to ask the person to please tell me what they think. Because if they get the book,
right.
they have to tell me their opinion. Yeah, I make them.
And tell
them
if they like
review.
It, log on to Amazon and write a review or write a review somewhere else. The more we can get the word out there, the better. And that's, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to interview me, and I appreciate you championing other authors. You know, it's really important that we have opportunities like this, and we can't do it without people like you. So I really appreciate the time
I
and the opportunity.
It. I don't mind
Great.
Doing this. And for those of you that think that Fran gets paid to do reviews, she doesn't. And for those of you that think I get paid to do the radio show, I don't. I pay for the network myself. So on behalf of Literary Viewpoints, MJ Network, in memory of my sister, thank you very much, everybody. It's a beautiful day outside. Have a nice day, and bye.